So as we're doing with the children, we're going to gather today around the most famous psalm, Psalm 23, "The Lord's My Shepherd." This psalm has been prominent in the faith life of the church, and indeed in the synagogue before it. A psalm of David, a psalm of the shepherd, about the shepherding of God. And there's something about this psalm that has spoken to generation upon generation. It was requested by Queen Victoria to be sung at her funeral, and she'd learned a new tune that had been put to the words of the Psalter version of the 23rd Psalm. And that was the tune Crimmond. And even to this day, we often sing that at the remembrance of someone's life. After she did it, it became so popular, the 23rd Psalm. And once again, Andrew Dunsire has made a presentation for us. And we're going to work through this. Use this as a meditation. Take some time to concentrate on the words of this wonderful psalm, and may it minister to you as we do so. This is Psalm 23, "The Lord's My Shepherd." The Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. He guides me along the right paths for His name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely, your goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life. And I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. This week I was gathered with a group of other local ministers. And we were talking with one another about the challenges of these days. And as we spoke with one another, Graham Duffin, who was hosting the chat online, had said that a minister friend of his called David Searle had sent a reflection, a daily reflection, through from the works of Max Lucado. Many of you have read books by Max Lucado. He's a wonderful writer. He has an incredible way of capturing things in words. And he spoke about the 23rd Psalm. And he spoke about it in these terms, that as we get to that turning point between the first part of the psalm where everything is going as it should, we get to that point where we're being told about walking through the darkest valley, or the valley of the shadow of death, as it says in the Old King James. And he spoke about this, grief but not despair, grieving but not despairing. And that's going to be our theme for today. Because as we go through these weeks and months, there's a tremendous amount that we have lost. But as we consider our lives and the lives of our families and friends, the life of our nation or our world, there's a proper grief attached to that. But I think there's a wisdom in this, that it's not God's purpose that that slips into despair. And as we talk through this, I want you to keep that in the back of your mind, or perhaps other experiences in your life where you have experienced grief and perhaps the temptation or the experience of despair. Let's look again at grief through the lens of the 23rd Psalm. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, even though the path I have to tread is surrounded by loss and grief and pain and suffering, David says, I will fear no evil. As he does so from the perspective of a shepherd, that as he puts his head on his roll sack or whatever it is he has, guarding the flock. Oftentimes what would happen at night is they gather the flock into a stone enclosure, and it was the task of the shepherd to lie across the entrance. He really was the gate that Jesus would speak. He speaks of being the good shepherd. He also speaks of being the door. And that's what a good shepherd did. He spoke about the hirelings that run at the first sign of trouble. But of course, he was the good shepherd. And we're going to look a bit further down that story in just a moment. But David writes this from the perspective of having been a shepherd. That training that prepared him to be king. Of looking after people. Of putting his life on the line on behalf of others. As he does when he faces Goliath. And of course, in the shameful episode with Uriah and Bathsheba, as he doesn't do on that occasion. When he's not at war and his eye turns and he takes what isn't his. And indeed, when the prophet Nathan comes to challenge David, it's again with a story about a sheep that's taken by a rich man from a poor man that Nathan challenges David's hypocrisy and wickedness and his abuse of power. But David writes here, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, the darkest valley, I will fear no evil. I don't know about your own experience in your life where you've had that sense that you were stepping into a situation that was hard, that was difficult, that brought up fear. For some of you, perhaps at school with bullies or a teacher who was tough. Perhaps at home, difficult situations at home. Perhaps you had a sibling who made life very, very hard for you. Perhaps life circumstances at work or with a sickness, with cancer, some degenerative disease, a difficult time of health around a heart attack or something of that nature. And of course, with the loss of a loved one, where we have to say goodbye to people that we would hold on to for the rest of our days. When we go into that situation, it's tempting to read this psalm and think, well, is the psalmist suggesting that we go through these times with a kind of Teflon coating, armor plating, that protects us from the horror of what's going on? But the very fact that we walk through these times is an indication that God knows, that we know, that grief is a part of life. Grieving is a part of living. Just as doubt is a part of faith, and as suffering is a part of living in a broken world. And the pain and the sadness of grief, though part of a broken world and though part of the badness around about, grief is actually part of what's good in us responding to the difficulties round about us. It was never intended that we be immune from them. We can look at organisms like ants. I'm not sure ants grieve. They just get on with the job of feeding the little ones, looking after the queen, and building a hive. Indeed, in many ways, in terms of numeracy and survivability, they're probably stronger than us. But they lack that godlike compassion, which makes us who we are, that ability to love, to lay down our life for our friends, though in their own way, ants can do that too and embody that corporately, fighting off threats to their nest. But grief is actually a sign that we love. It's an important thing. It's a reflex, like anger is when something bad happens, where there's injustice or suffering or pain caused by a situation or a person. Grief is something that God has given us. And of course, after Jesus has said that I'm a good shepherd, the very next story in John's account of Jesus' life is the story of the death of his friend. Jesus delays going to Bethany a couple of days. He's on his way to Jerusalem. And in John's account of that, he stops in Bethany, as many pilgrims did. The surrounding area around Jerusalem swelled at every time, maybe 3, 4, 5 times the population of Jerusalem, which was maybe ordinarily about 60,000. The Romans brought in extra troops to manage because 250,000 or so would be there in pilgrimage at the Passover festival. Many of them camped out in the surrounding towns, and one of those would have been Bethany. And here we approach the story of Jesus' friend. He delays those couple of days. He's heard that Lazarus is sick, and he makes his way there. And of course, Martha and Mary, they're filled with grief, and the challenge comes to Jesus. You know, why didn't you come? You could have healed him. And Jesus calls Lazarus from the grave. But before he does that, there's the shortest verse in all of the scriptures. In our English translation of John 11:35, the two words are, Jesus wept. Jesus wept. He already knows that it's for his Father's glory that this is to happen, that there's a sign here that Jesus is giving of his power over the grave. And even though Lazarus would have a second funeral, there are some things that are more remarkable. Lazarus is 4 days in the grave. He comes out in his grave clothes. When Jesus asks for the stone to be moved, there's the complaint that the stench will be there. It's a remarkable miracle. And indeed, in Matthew's gospel, as we said, as we looked at the road to Emmaus, that incredible account that there's people rise from the dead, Lazarus is one of them. And that's before the resurrection. There's echoes in Matthew's account of this event in John 11. But before Lazarus is raised from the grave, Jesus goes through the grief of the death of his friend, even though he knows, he trusts that God will resurrect him. That like using a credit card that he will pay for at the cross, Jesus is using his power, his calling ahead of time to raise Lazarus from the grave. But before that, Jesus grieves. Sometimes it's tempting that I've seen presentations of the Christian life that we live a victorious life, and yes, we do, but the victorious life is the victorious life of the army that's overcome in battle, not of the army that's been untouched. And there's a grief in victory as well as there's a grief in defeat. And Jesus here reflects the nature of grieving, that Jesus himself grieved. At another point in the Psalms, it speaks of how God collects our tears in a bottle, that he grieves with us. This was something that the classical Greek and Roman mind couldn't get their heads around. How could God grieve? For that indicates change, and that which is perfect can't change. But we don't believe in God as a concept. We believe that God has full personhood. And as God the Son walked the earth, he grieved. Indeed, he probably grieved at the grave of his own father, even before the start of his ministry. There's no mention of Joseph after the birth narratives in Luke and in Matthew. Jesus grieves. And he grieves with us still. That he's with us in the sorrow. He's with us in the loss. He's with us as we say goodbye. He's with us as we recall to mind all of those things that we have lost in terms of our ability, in terms of our hopefulness, in terms of meaningful labor, in terms of relationship, in terms of companionship, whatever it may be, in terms of the death of a loved one. I stood at a graveside this week of a lovely local lady. And in her last, her daughter said, she said, I just want to be with Jesus. She was in her 90s, and her time here is coming to an end. But of course, for her family, that means grief. And that's the story of Lazarus. And the wonderful thing about it is we see Jesus here, shouldering up the grief of Martha and Mary. But it's grief, but not despair. What's the difference? Grief shows that our emotions are alive to that sense of loss, that we go through the feelings and emotions as we consider in our minds what it is that we have lost or what it is that others have lost, particularly at this time, that day this week when the statistics were added of the deaths of people in care homes. And of course, to that we add our beloved Margaret McNeil. And that big jump in figures of 6,000 or so in one day, and we felt that. That's grief. What's the difference between grief and despair? What is the difference between grief and despair? Grief is something that God gives us. Many of the Psalms express grief. And sometimes those psalms tip into despair. Psalm 88, if you want to, you can go read it. That's the psalm that tips us close to despair. You see moments in Job's account of his suffering where it tips into despair. You can see that at the beginning of 2 Corinthians as Paul talks about a difficult time. Tom Wright typifies it as he looked at Paul's letter and tries to reconstruct his life, that there was a breakdown of hope there. And I think that's what despair is. We can grieve, but still hope. We can grieve at the graveside of a loved one, but still have our hope in Jesus, who straightens everything out, who resurrects the dead, and in whose keeping our loved ones, as they put their trust in Him, are safe. Indeed, they're more secure in the keeping of Jesus than they are when they're living and breathing here, even though it may not feel like it. But despair is something else. Despair is an expression of the black hole of nihilism, of total destruction, where everything breaks apart, where everything tends to nothing. One of the insights of modern physics is that left to its own devices, the universe over an unimaginably long period of time will eventually cool to darkness and effectively die. And the only hope really for us in the light of that is it's an unimaginably large distance in the future. But that's a kind of physical expression of despair. It's something that scientists call entropy. And in that expression that things tend towards chaos, towards that they break apart. In the midst of that, here are we, these remarkable, strange, complex beings whom I believe God has placed here, full of emotions, full of experiences, full of hopes and fears, full of all sorts of things. And that when we lose, we set great store. But the very fact that we grieve is a sign that we had a hope that it was going to be different. Isn't it remarkable that out of many of the suffering of the Jewish people, the suffering of the slaves in the Caribbean and in the south of the United States, these great songs and messages of hope came out because they learned that there was a Redeemer, one who could free them from slavery, one who could free them from the torment they were in, one who could free them from the oppressor, one who could free them from whichever imperial power had control of Israel at that time. And those expressions of hope come from a place of suffering. Because we can grieve but not despair. Despair is the loss of hope. Diane had a professor when she was studying for her nursing studies. I remember going to a lunchtime lecture that she held. Her name was Penny Prophet, and she was a nun, and she was the professor in the nursing studies department at Edinburgh University. And she said this: the most profound suffering is the passing of hope into despair. And she said, for some people, that's the death of their hamster. For others, it's the death of loved ones, or the loss of work, or the loss of sanity. It may be any one or a number of these things. And it's very easy to judge from the outside where that might be. Sometimes we wonder why people lose their footing at certain points in their life. But because we aren't them, we don't understand. We don't understand that what has happened is the passing of hope into despair. It may be the remembrance of some suffering very early in childhood, sometimes remembered, sometimes not until much later. And the passing of hope into despair involves a profound suffering, because despair dictates that the future is awful. We can grieve and still hope, but if we're caught in despair, that's something else. And what Max Lucado would say is that what Jesus wants to rescue us from, what happens in the cross, is a way is opened to draw us out of despair. Despair is one of the things that's nailed to the cross, along with nihilism and hopelessness, the blackness of the notion that all there is blackness and nothingness at the end of our lives. Indeed, the very life which we have been given as a gift by God, as a gift, contains within it the hope that we need. Liam and I were talking just before the live stream, and we were talking about how there's something about us, and that Genesis 2 account of how we're made from the dust, and yes, we're made of chemicals. The compounds that make up our body are made of the very basic building blocks of the universe, yet there's something in us, a spark. Genesis 2, we call it the ruach, the breath, the life, the wind of God, breathed into us that makes us different. And that very life is the difference between despair and hope. It's what Ezekiel sees in Ezekiel 37, where the valley of dry bones are given sinew, then they're given flesh, but they're still just made of dust. It's not until the wind of God, the ruach of God, in that prophetic retelling of the Genesis 2 story is said again, spoken over them, the breath, the spirit, the life of God. It's the same word in Hebrew. Ruach is breathed over them, that then they come to life. The very life that we have is a gift from God. And that very life contains the hope, that seed of hope, which is designed to protect us from despair. We contend towards that in our brokenness. But what God would have us is, instead of despairing, through the power of the cross, through the death and resurrection of Jesus, that we're restored to a place of living hope, even though we will face death and destruction and hopelessness and darkness in these days. Well, what evidence do I have for that? What evidence do I have for that? When Cleopas and his companion, or perhaps his wife, they make their way back up to Jerusalem, they meet with the apostles. And of course, one of them is Peter. And this is what Peter writes later on to the church, when it itself is undergoing enormous persecution under the wicked Roman Emperor Nero, around 65 AD or so. I'm going to read this to you from 1 Peter 1. Verses 3 through 9. Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In His great mercy, He has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, and into an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade. This inheritance is kept in heaven for you, who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming of the salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time. In all of this, you greatly rejoice, though now for a while you suffer all kinds of trials. These have come so that the proven genuineness of your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes, even though refined by fire, may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. Though you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and are filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy, for you are receiving the end result of your faith, the salvation of your souls. Notice how Peter paraphrases what Jesus says to Thomas when he says, you know, you've seen and believed, but blessed are those who haven't seen and believed. You see these echoes throughout the letters that the apostles write. And Peter is saying here that praise to God extends to this great and glorious hope that we have through the death and resurrection of Jesus. That living hope has been given to us, even though we're persecuted, even though we go through trials. And he does what the Jewish people do. And he says, even though we're suffering, and that suffering appears to be at the hands of an evil power, or perhaps an illness, or the decisions of people who do not have our best interests at heart, even though it looks like they're the ones who are in charge, Jesus is Lord, and that suffering contains in it something that will purify our faith, encourage us in our hope, even though we pass through the valley of the greatest darkness, of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil. Why? Because by God's grace, that evil can be used to help strengthen and perfect our faith. Not to protect us entirely from suffering, but that in, out, and through it, we learn how to hope and not despair. And that's said by Peter, who in that same persecution was executed for his faith. Paul would go on, and I want to read you another passage. This is from 2 Corinthians. I've referenced 2 Corinthians already. And from 2 Corinthians 4, Jesus says this is just the most wonderful, wonderful metaphor of what we are. He says, but we have this treasure in jars of clay. In other words, we have all the riches that God has given us in these mortal bodies to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. We are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not abandoned. Struck down, but not destroyed. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake so that this life may also be revealed in our mortal body. So then death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. What Paul's saying here is that the deepest darkness, the valleys through which we go, the things that might crush us, those things perfect our faith. Those things, the very things that we fear would destroy us, can actually be repurposed by the Spirit of God so that we become more like Jesus and our hope is more grounded. For we've been through the valley of the shadow of death and we now know that there's more heaven than hell. We now know that the kingdom of God overcomes the kingdom of darkness. We now know that the deceitful murder perpetrated by King David leads to the repentance and the restoration of the shepherd king in whose image the Messiah will finally come. And we know that that Messiah will be a good shepherd. Friends, in these dark days, I realize how it's easy from the safety of this chair, and indeed from the safety of the surroundings here, to speak into situations that many of which I do not even know about. But from my own experience, from my watching what Jesus does in the lives of others, I trust that he can work all things together for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose, as Paul will write in the book of Romans. We see it in the life of Peter. We see it in the life of Paul. We see it in the life of David. We see it in the life of Lazarus. We see it in the life of Jesus. That the suffering that we go through, sometimes I wonder that the most profound witness that we have as Christians is as other people who don't know Him watch us suffer. And they see that spark in us that carries us through life's trials and difficulties, through our own sin and shame, through the things that are of no design of our own but happen to us. And yet in us, they see Jesus. Laid bare, raw, real, but glorious nonetheless. Now, just before we close with the words of this psalm, it might be that you yourself are right in the pit of despair just now. You may not know why, or maybe perhaps you do. First of all, know that God is with you. And that the despair that you are experiencing just now is part of what Jesus shoulders up at the cross. And that He is with you, never more than a prayer away. Take the opportunity to even if all you can say is, I don't believe you're there, but as the psalmist sometimes says, where are you? But then goes on to speak about the troubles. Be like that. May perhaps read the Psalms. Find in Psalm 20. Psalm 20 is a good psalm if you're going through a tough time. Psalm 91. Psalm 27. I would encourage you to find your hope in Jesus, even though it may seem all hope is lost. And if you find yourself at that lowest ebb, reach out to someone. Reach out to someone and reach out to that same Jesus who died and rose again to give you hope. But it may also be, as we're talking about this, you're reminded of a time when you went through great despair, and it might be that you've yet to come through the other side of that. It could take years. But this I want to say to you is that the manufacture of durable hope on the rock-solid foundation of Jesus is a lifetime process. And there's storms. It's challenged, but in Jesus that hope is sure. And finally, for all of us, don't let your hope be in your own strength. Indeed, God's strength is made perfect in our weakness. Don't let your hope be in the NHS or the protections around about, grateful as we are for those. May your hope be in Jesus. And may you be listening for His call to step into whatever situations He has for you to be Jesus to others in, especially at this time. And may the words of this psalm as we close minister to you as a prayer. And just as we close, remember how many times in this psalm the psalmist uses the word you. He speaks to God directly. Make sure you take time in prayer. For in there we find ourselves. Our crookedness is straightened out. And we find the true self that God made us to be. May God bless you all at this time. Let's return to this psalm. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil. For you are with me. Your rod and staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely your goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever, that though I may grieve, I won't despair, because the Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. Amen.